Hello, hello. Welcome, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Get all settled in. Good to see some familiar faces as well. My name is Calvin Cupini. I am with Activate and hosting our podcast today, which is an exploration of VC in climate tech, where we enable each other, where we push things forward, and where we adapt our strategies in order to make this more possible. We'll have a podcast today where I have three esteemed guests who are partners, founders, GPs, and investment firms, as well as tech industry experts and South by Southwest elite. I'll start by introducing my panel first. Molly Wood, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thanks, Calvin. I'm certain he doesn't. Look at, by the way, the difference in crowd on an afternoon panel, because it's effectively morning at South by Southwest, I know. They're still serving breakfast tacos. I'm Molly Wood. I am a longtime tech and business journalist turned climate tech journalist turned investor. And so now I have a company. I am a founder. I have a company where I do climate solutions media in the form of a podcast called Everybody in the Pool. I was previously a managing director at Launch, and now I'm a venture partner with Amasia, where we invest in climate tech solutions, primarily of the software variety, which I'm here to somewhat represent today, somewhat controversially represent.
We also have Matthew Norden of Azola Ventures.
Hey, folks, how you doing today? That's what we want to hear. I'm Matthew Norden. I'm one of three general partners at a firm called Azola Ventures. In some ways, we look like a lot of other organizations that invest in technology propositions to try to mitigate climate change. We in particular fund crazy early stage companies like concept formation stage, coming right out of a university stage companies that could have a gigaton scale impact on net CO2e emissions by 2050. But in other ways, we're a little weird, and there are two of them. One of them is that we only invest in solution areas that could be a big swing at bat for emissions reduction on the same scale as solar and wind are today at a human relevant time frame, kind of 1.5 industrial cycles by 2050. The other part of our mandate, and it is a mandate, it's not a preference or something we have a bias toward, but something we are required to deliver on for the limited partners who gave us the money to invest, is that we only invest catalytically. So if a founding team that we like going out and raising money, they've got a bunch of competing term sheets. There are many ways for the business to be funded. That's great. We are cheering for them from the sidelines. It's not our mission. Our mission is to fund neglected opportunities where the round is unlikely to come together unless we lead it or complete it. And we're playing a catalytic role to bring a venture to life substantially earlier, or maybe not at all, than it would have otherwise.
We have a lot of questions about how that works as well later. But first, Craig Lawrence as well.
Thank you. Craig Lawrence. I am a co-founder and partner at Energy Transition Ventures. We're a early stage venture fund based here in Texas. I actually live in Austin. I think I'm the only one up here. And we are investing in companies that are either driving or benefiting from the transition from traditional energy sources, fossil fuels, to all the new and exciting energy sources I think many of us are investing in. Let's see. Yeah, the fund's 3 years old. We invest across the broad swath of early stage. We'll do some of the stuff that Matt does and take stuff out of the university lab. We'll do seed stage investments, and we'll do later stage investments. And along with Matt, I know, and I think Molly as well too, and everyone up here, I've been doing this for now a long time. Before we got up here, I realized I started in this area in 2003, so I'm over 20 years now, thrice as an engineer, as an investor, and then helping run companies all around all the different segments we now invest in. So excited to be here.
Love that. We'll have a really good long-range perspective when we get to that as well. My name is Calvin. As I said, I'm with Activate, which is a program for scientists to spin up companies, usually out of their academic programs and PhDs, sometimes national labs and corporates. But we give them 2 years of non-dilutive runway in order to bring some of the hardest ideas to market, like carbon capture for sustainable aviation fuels or making steel with lasers, without taking any equity out of the company, which makes it really special. But it means we need to work with investors and experts in the field in order to help them get that to market, because it takes a heck of a lot more than just one program or one person in order to do so. Molly, you've seen some of this arc. Where has climate tech investing come? Where did it start, or what kind of humble beginnings did you see first?
So it was probably 2016 or 2017 when I was at Marketplace on NPR hosting a show called Marketplace Tech, and I started thinking, climate is one of those things, right, that's always on your mind at some point. And that 2016 or 2017 is when I thought, okay, how can I make this my story? It took me an embarrassingly long couple of weeks to realize, like, oh, this is the biggest tech and business story in the world. We should make this a central part of the show. And I went knocking on doors in the Valley. This is sort of in this, like, mid, which you are all familiar with, right? This is in this, like, weird middle ground between climate tech 1.0, the Valley of Death. We're now calling it Mountains of Opportunity. We've rebranded, thanks to Dr. Evelyn Wang at ARPA-E. And I went knocking on doors in Silicon Valley. I thought, okay, well, I have an idea. I feel like the tech industry is always telling me that they are here to fix a lot of things and save the world. So I bet somebody's working on this. I should go find out. And literally the genesis of this series was to go knock on the doors of Facebook and Apple and Google and Google's X, and a bunch of venture capital firms and say, what are you doing? And what is weird about that, because it was 2017, and here we are now in a completely different environment, is that for the most part, the answer was not very much in terms of the tech companies. And we feel like we want to do more, but we're pretty gun shy on the side of the VCs. So the ramp up in just that, actually shockingly kind of long time now, almost 7-year period, has been phenomenal, really good hockey stick growth. And yet, I think now we're at this moment of really, I would argue, and you two know better than I do, reevaluation of where we are and what the incentives are and if this round is going to work.
Especially in the last 3 years, say around 2020, we saw a huge spike in interest in climate and climate tech innovations and investment and valuation of these companies. Matthew, where did that come from, and what did that leave us with?
Yeah, you know, everything goes in cycles, right? And we learn things along the way. I think Silicon Valley's first flirtation with this category that happened in the 2000s was when a very large amount of venture money had been raised toward the end of the, 2000s tech bubble. And you had general partners at venture firms, people like folks on the table here, who had raised a very large amount of money to deploy into telecom and e-commerce, et cetera. All the air went out of the balloon, and I think there was kind of a fumbling around in the dark for a new bubble. And if that sounds a little pejorative, I mean it pejoratively. And you had this kind of moment where the U.S. was entering the Kyoto Protocol. Fracking had not yet impacted the price of oil and gas. Price of oil was at, a near all-time high. There was a promise of the negative externality of emissions being priced. And I think you had very smart people, but who were not trained in these kind of industrial categories in the real economy of making steel or glass or pulp and paper or fuels or enabling transport, taking lessons they had learned from software and from biotech investing, neither of which look anything like this. In terms of time, money, risk, margin structure, exit multiples, none of those things, and kind of misapplying a toolkit to a field that raised a lot of money and then spectacularly busted, right? You had this horrible moment, in the late 2000s, where the price of natural gas went from $12 a million BTU to $2. The price of oil went from $100 a barrel to the 20s. Waxman-Markey, which would have priced carbon, passed the House, failed in the Senate, and everything kind of died. And that period, Molly, that you referred to, that kind of weird interregnum, is where our organization was actually born as a 501c3 public charity called Prime Coalition that had the point of view, the tide is completely out on a field where investment interests cannot go up and down, right, like fashion trends. It has to have an enduring backstop of investment, whether it is in play or not in play among mainstream investors. And we developed our investment thesis about this idea of investing the highest and best use of the dollar in an impact first view of the world for emissions reduction, not thinking that impact is, you know, antithetical to investment returns, but rather that they come hand in hand. If you solve a very large, important human problem at a scale where you have a company that can attract continued investment in a sustainable way that rewards everyone on the table, it's a logical conclusion, it will be lucrative. The arrow of causation's just changed, right? It's not you build a big self-sustaining company and you might get a pleasant side effect of emissions reduction. It's you solve a problem of emissions reduction, you are prima facie, if you do that in a sustainable way, going to get a big lucrative company that can stand on its own. So I think that's where we got. What I'm excited about this kind of generation of investment is that it is all different. There's a learning opportunity from everything that did not work the first time around. There is a generation of CEOs and founders that weren't looking at a $100 barrel of oil price and thinking, if I can compete against that, I'm fine. They were born into hardship. They were born into having difficult competitive landscapes that they had to beat on their own merits. And you have kind of a supply chain of financing from what we do at the ultra early stage to people at the much later stage funding first of a kind project finance that gives these companies a path to get to impact at scale that just didn't exist 10 or 15 years ago. And that makes me feel good. It makes me feel like now's the right time.
2003 would have been pretty tough then for energy transition ventures to get started. Would have been much smaller and maybe even called something different at the time. How did you differentiate from just any other venture capital firm that saw climate as a market opportunity? What kind of skills did you need and expertise did you need to have to make it work?
To be fair, I was not doing venture capital in 2003. So I was an engineer working on fuel cells and solar product design and engineering. So I didn't really think about that stuff back then. I just remember the first time I was introduced to a solar panel was around that time. And I had been an engineer, you know, for many years already then. And it was explained to me by the CEO of First Solar, now a very successful company, was a little bit smaller back then, that light hits this thing and electricity comes off of it. And I was like, how come nobody's told me about this? Like, what? So the first part of my career, I was not thinking about investment until about 2008, which is right at the peak of that first wave. And there was a lot of capital. And there's a firm in Silicon Valley called Accel Partners. And there was a partner there that was very interested in this area and was watching all his peers. Accel Partners, one of the venerated firms, as was Venrock, as was Kleiner Perkins, as was Kosla Ventures and Sequoia Ventures, and they were all putting money into this sector. And the partners at Accel were kind of looking at each other going, what's going on? These guys are violating every rule our elders taught us about venture capital. You don't invest in commodities. You don't invest in things selling to highly regulated industries, et cetera. You don't invest in these very capital-intensive projects. And they're like, but our LPs are telling us to go look at this, right? They're asking, how come you're not doing it? Kleiner's doing it. Venrock's doing it. And so we dabbled in it. I joined and we dabbled. And it was an interesting experiment that had a couple very successful outcomes and then ended. For me in 2010. They're like, this is crazy. We're not going to do this. So I went on and worked in the solar industry for a decade before I jumped back into investing. And the reason I jumped back in with my co-founder, who has been in this space a long time too, is we saw several things that had changed. Matthew mentioned one of them, which is the capital stack across from early stage, which I think what happened to a lot of these companies that were formed in 05, 07, 08, they raised a lot of money. They actually got to some interesting technical proof points and demonstration, but then they needed hundreds of millions of dollars of more capital to build factories and other things, and some of them pulled it off. Others, there just wasn't a mature capital stack. Now corporates, government funding, nonprofit funding, just private capital all along the stack. So we saw all the money coming in. And then we saw everybody who was doing early stage investing, except for Matthew and a couple others, had left. So anyone who had any experience doing it sort of moved on back to tech, back to whatever. And so there's a whole new crop of people doing the early stage. And my partner Neil and I said, oh, we kind of know how to do this. So this would be a good time. All that later stage capital needs product, right? It needs companies. And these companies need to be built. And companies like groups like Activate and Matthew's group and everybody are just creating this super diverse type of support for these companies that did not exist. I mean, we didn't really even have incubators like Techstars and stuff back then. I mean, and so it seemed like such a more healthy environment to go try to build these companies, and so that's why we're back.
This also presents, though, a complication for a founder to navigate all of that and to sort of work through, maybe even have a CFO to kind of put all these things together. Do you take grant funding or put a lot of effort into receiving a federal grant? Do you look for early project finance and venture debts? Is it net-net better off for the founder today with all of these options, or has the complexity and challenge just moved to navigating the resources that we have today?
I think it's much better, but you do have to, as a founder, you have to do the work to figure it out. I tell founders all the time, particularly ones that are doing, you know, true research, like, you should not be coming to me right now. There are other options for you, or have you explored all the other options that are either non-dilutive or much less dilutive than what we're doing to get you to a stage where someone like us can look at it and go, okay, so I'm not doing fundamental research anymore, I'm doing development. We can get comfortable with development. Fundamental materials research, not saying we don't do it because we've done it a couple times, it's not really a great use of venture equity.
Yeah. Equity being one of the most expensive dollars you can take on. Molly, does this still boil down to storytelling for a founder? You still have to craft something to say, I can win this and here's why?
Well, you do, but storytelling takes many forms. And as you were talking, I was thinking it is also the burden of, I think, the VCs, especially, you know, those of you who have been in this space for a really long time. These founders are coming along and they don't know that what they need now is non-dilutive funding. They don't totally understand that VCs don't invest in bench scale technology unless they do. They don't understand that, you know, there may be a wealth of opportunities across the capital stack except growth, and that it is in fact the, we'll talk about the barbell at some point, I'm sure, on this panel, but that it is also, I think, very helpful when the investors in this space who know it well and who have been part of it for a long time can say to those founders, this is actually, these are the options on the table. This sounds like a rejection because I'm telling you that your technology is bench scale and we don't do that. But what it really is an opportunity for you not to give away your company too early and be forced to grow in a direction that isn't the right thing for your solution.
So just one thought on that. Let's gauge the room here. Can you raise your hand if you were a founder or an aspiring founder? Raise them high.
Oh, phenomenal.
Okay, that's good. That's like a third, 40% of the room. So the first thing, speaking directly to you, so we are for you, all right? We take sides, we're for you. The planet will keep on cycling, right? Geologists would tell you, Craig mentioned this earlier on, oh, this is all gonna blow over, give it a few million years, everything's cool. Everything's cool, but not for us. And we don't end up solving those problems without your spark, right? To the point that you made, I think it is much better to be an entrepreneur in this category or any category today than it was, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. The wealth of resources that you have in incubators, accelerators, peer groups, other people that you can listen to on YouTube, just unlike what anything was like a decade or two ago. I think the important thing is not to take your eye off the prize, because there is so much grant money being thrown around, because there are large corporations you would never expect. I was in a board meeting for one of our portfolio companies in nature-based solutions for climate change, and they were like, yeah, we had this really good meeting with Netflix's nature-based solutions head. And I'm like, I know all those words, but in that order? Like, could I have imagined that 10 years ago? All of that's great, but you've got to remain focused on the idea that these propositions win because they win in a marketplace and they're better than the things they replace. They're better techno-economically, they're easier to adopt, they're less of a pain, they're faster to use, they cost less. And I think there are now propositions running around that are chasing the latest grant funding opportunity, that are trying to like follow a trend of what tech companies have in favor or not in favor of how they approach emissions reduction. All that stuff doesn't matter. I think if you look at the winning propositions in this space historically, you talked about First Solar, which was not taken seriously when it was called Glass Tech and was a crazy idea. You know, for all the, what's the right word to use? Idiosyncrasies of its CEO, Tesla did not get to the point that it's at of driving the rest of the auto industry to electrify a decade or two faster than they would have otherwise because it chased subsidies or tried to make some specialty vehicle appealing to current fashion sentiment. It's because there was this dogged determination on making something just fundamentally better, cooler to drive, more reliable, sort of holds its value better. And I think the extent that you stay focused on that, outcompeting the dirty, messy, polluting, negative externality proliferating things that came before you, that's like the oasis to keep in your eyes as you go up and down the dunes in the desert.
On that note, though, you mentioned Prime Coalition starting in a 501c3. Plenty of climate philanthropy is out there, but you're looking for a business case to make it stick. How do you measure? What are some of the frameworks that you have used at Azola to make sure it does both good and well?
So the genesis of organization, as you mentioned, is this 501c3 public charity, Prime Coalition, founded by its executive director, Sarah Carney. I joined her to build the organization as a volunteer very early, sort of at the concept stage. And we, you know, evolved what we did over time. One of the observations that we had, right, was that industrial time cycles can be long. So you want to, like, write software that's a consumer app, it goes on a marketplace, you know pretty quickly whether or not it's working. There's just an incompressible time constant. To figuring out that your low-carbon cement approach or your electrolyzer, you know, for making green hydrogen to replace natural gas, you can't cram that, you know, into a 1 or 2 year development period. It doesn't work. So you need to have a source of capital that is aligned for a longer time frame, a little bit more risk, than is rewarded by mainstream finance. That's not, you know, an idea that you are backing bad ideas, or that in the limit, you are going to be limited by lower returns necessarily. It means that you have a different risk-reward ratio, right? You are willing to take more risk in service of higher reward. And there is a universe of capital that is willing to do that from high-risk-tolerant foundation endowments and ultra-high-net-worth individuals through to the grant-making side of philanthropies. So one thing that we did was to try to create a structure that from a legal and regulatory standpoint could take the broadest range of sources of capital that were aligned toward impact-first investing. Then the second, once you follow that, is, well, if you've got this scarce, ultra-high-risk capital, how do you drive it toward things where it can have the biggest bang for the buck? So we developed a methodology initially with, you know, grad students on tape and baling wire, then became a real methodology, now is a software tool that you can use. Go to cranetool.org. You will find a tool called CRANE, Carbon Reduction Assessment for New Enterprises, that has many thousands of users, has become something of a de facto standard in the field, and work out what your prospective emissions reduction potential is. And then the third part was to figure out, well, you also want to have that money go toward its greatest bang for the buck. You should only do that in cases that are on the margin, you know, where something is almost there, might be able to get financed, can't get quite across the line, the risk tolerance isn't there. I think the trick that's weird, and when I say it to my venture friends, they sort of slowly start to back the truck up a little bit, is that if you want to do that, you need to do it for real. Who in here, raise your hand if you watch Silicon Valley on HBO.
The documentary series.
The documentary series, well put. Right? You know the recurring joke in that was that every founder shows up, says, we're making the world a better place through, and only the end of the sentence changes. Automated JSON queries, you know, whatever it is. That's regression to the mean. That's, you know, sort of signaling virtue while doing what everybody else is doing. We built our structure weirdly so that that assessment of emission reduction and that assessment of additionality or a catalytic nature is not made by our investment team. It's made by a separate nonprofit whose word is law and where there is no appeal process. And that's designed to make sure that we don't get our heads up our own selves, if I will speak politely, and start just doing whatever is trendy at the time, and instead stay focused on truly neglected opportunity areas.
Capital intensivity was brought up, and I want to go to Craig. It's a double-edged sword to have a company that is quick to build and quick to get to market and quick to build a product and revenue, but also quick to have competitors, because once the idea is out, so too can others come. I'll take a raise of hands. Is anyone working in hardware, deep tech, tough tech, R&D, science? All right, and then the software folks. Anybody in software, products, SaaS? Okay, got a good 50-50 split. Talk about the double-edged sword of capital intensivity, though, that it takes $100 million to get there, but so too it does for your competitors.
So I think I think about this weirdly, strangely, differently than others. I think Silicon Valley and venture capital love capital-intensive businesses. If you look at Facebook, you know, any of these big, big tech companies, they raised hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars because when a VC sees a winner or a growth investor sees a winner, they want to put as much money as they can into it, whether it's useful or not. So I think there's sort of a, people use this capital intensity as an excuse to not invest in something because they don't believe in it or they don't understand it or otherwise. So I'm not afraid of capital intensive businesses because if they're good, the capital will be there. If they're not good, well, then that doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter whether they're capital intensive or not. They won't get funded to the point where they need to be. I also, I see investors confusing research and development all the time. And I talked about that. Development, in at least the way I think about it, is you are not reinventing science. You are taking established principles, whether you establish them in the research phase or they're known, and you're making something, a product, right? And there's engineering and there's other, you know, other challenges to go. But those typically are predictable and plannable challenges. Research is not. Research can be extremely capital intensive because you don't know when you're going to have a result. You don't know how long, how many people, how much equipment, you know. And so I everyone lumps all that into deep tech, but it's not all created equal at all. So, I mean, venture capital loves hardware also. There's so many successful hardware companies that have been VC funded, but they're not doing some fundamental research. They're just building an awesome product, right? Tesla is that way. I mean, they did a lot of good engineering, but they didn't recreate the battery to launch that company, right? They built an awesome car. So I think the capital intensity thing is a bit of a myth in this space.
It feels like it would be more accurate but less user-friendly to instead talk about IRR, right? To say they're not so worried about giving you tons of money because funds got real big and there is a lot of money to deploy. They have to write big checks because that money has to go somewhere. They just want that return rate to be fast. And so then that becomes this kind of stressor, and that's where I feel like your point about the difference between research and development is really important. And then on your question of what to look for within that return profile, I mean, I do think there are certain things that are markers, even if it's difficult, of success, right? Like I had Brimstone on the show, which makes a cement replacement, and that founder talked about how important it is to make a cement replacement that is exactly the same as cement, that has been certified to be identical to Portland cement, the kind that everybody uses. That adaptability, you know, that there are markers. Adaptability, the ability to adopt a solution without having to fundamentally change your entire workflow, that's a big deal. The ability to create market pull with your product, to say it's so obvious how good it is that people will clamor to make it better. There are those markers of success, and they can overcome the built-in obstacle that is like, well, this is really complicated technology, or it's hardware, God forbid. I sit on both sides, clearly, of the software-hardware divide, but I think it is, it's sellable. We just have to be honest about what we mean when we say capital intensity.
The IRR question is even not that clear. When I was at Accel, they were the first institutional check into Facebook, and I watched that company for years, where they're telling them, don't go for profitability. We want to just keep pumping money with no return because they saw the light at the end, right? And it took many, many years before they ever turned a profit, right? But now they made a great return for investors because they knew what the markets eventually wanted, which was growth, right?
Let's pull back the curtain a little bit. Not enough founders talk about the fact that the VC themselves are also fundraising. and they're having a conversation just beyond that conversation to justify their worth to another set of investors who are a mysterious and quiet breed that are out there in the ether of 401k funds, family offices, sometimes large corporates. Craig, I want to start with you. How does that conversation translate when you're trying to make the same case to invest in your fund? What do they need to know? What do they need to see? How do you sell it to them upwards that this is also the greatest return profile for a teacher's retirement plan?
Right. I'll just, the first thing you just made me think of is when I tried to explain, when we launched this fund, my daughter was young and I was trying to explain to her what we did. I was like, we invest in these companies. She's like, oh, it's our money. And I go, well, no, not really. I'm getting money from other people. And she's like, so you just take their money and give it to somebody else? What do you do? And I was like, oh, God. So your question. What we found, and we do not have a very broad base of LPs in our current fund, and we're about to go out and raise a second fund, so I'll have new data to tell you about that. But in our first fund, because we were a first-time fund, first-time fund managers, we looked for a very specific profile of investor, one who you didn't need to convince that this was important or valuable or could provide returns, because we had to convince them that we were the ones who could actually do it. If they were starting from the convince me that clean tech, climate tech is a good idea, we were out. we had no shot. And then we, you know, further winnowed that down to people who it made sense to give us a check of the size that made sense for our small first fund. And I will say we did get some money from some people who were doing first time, what they called sustainability investing. That's how they were referring to it. I think the story that we have told them, which I think is different than Matthew and maybe different than Molly, which is we are using the venture capital vehicle to try to make returns. Our belief is that our returns have to be competitive with the top quartile, decile of all venture capital, not just climate venture capital. Otherwise, we will not be successful, because while it may be hot right now for institutions to put money into this, that is fleeting. At the end of the day, their job is to make returns, so our job is to make returns. And so what we've been able to convince our investors is that we are using the venture capital vehicle. We understand that vehicle. We understand what you expect. We understand what we expect from the startups. And so that takes us out of a lot of areas of investing that it just kind of doesn't make sense to do, which other people are luckily coming in and filling the gap for that.
Molly, if we say the quiet part out loud, 2020 through 2022 and a half was incredibly frothy and possibly noise compared to the rest of the actual arc of the market. Did that help or hurt us?
I think this will be the year we sort of find out, it seems like, right? This is going to be the year when a lot of our portfolio companies either make it or don't. And I can tell you that internally, a lot of the conversations I was having and hearing were, oh, we are making a lot of the same mistakes of Cleantech 1.0. The prices are too high. You know, the funds got too big and we're funding ideas that we know aren't going to make it, or we're going to fund these companies to a Series B, turn them out for a Series C, and there's going to be nowhere for them to land. I would love to know what you think. It seems so far like it's not going to be as bad as I may have initially thought in terms of the kind of the mountains of opportunity in 2024. But it's always dangerous when too much money goes in the same direction. Any good investor will tell you, whether they're, you know, an equity investor or a VC, that ideally you are not going where all the money is going. And we had a lot of all the money going in the same direction in that period of time. And I do worry about the barbell of a ton of money at the early stage and then some good, you know, first of a kind financing on the other end and not a whole lot in the middle. And I think this year and next is probably when we'll find out what is in the middle, where what nets exist to catch I call them baby turtles. Like being an early stage investor is like sending a bunch of baby turtles toward the ocean, and you know a lot of them are going to get picked off by gulls, which is dark, but true. So we're going to find out how many turtles make it to the sea.
I think that's why people use shots on goal, because there's less
shots
turtles
on goal
dying.
Might be better. Maybe I should rethink it. But it's nature-based as a metaphor.
It is nature-based. Matt, did we just move the Valley of Death? Is that what happened? We filled the seed and A rounds with plenty of early stage capital and excitement in climate tech, and then we just added a drop off at Series B and C when it's time to build your first plant or hire your 100th employee. Is that kind of where the new gap is?
It's kind of hard for me to think about that question when I'm contemplating baby turtle death, but nature abhors a vacuum and so does finance, right? There will be momentary ups and downs, and there will be ones that will be hard to tease apart from the macro. Like, what we haven't talked about here is what happens to this category if the U.S. is involved in military conflict in Iran or, you know, the South China Sea. What happens if there is a long overdue stock market correction that leads to a denominator effect where, as go prices of public equities, so go cash outflows into venture and private equity funds. So hard to tease that apart. But I'm actually not sure that's the case. There's a cycle where there is a lot of early stage money, and the early stage money exists because it is the smallest quantum to deploy and easiest to get capital formation around. It launches a lot of experiments. Trying not to go back to baby turtles, a large number of those will fail.
You just gotta lean in.
It's painful, but it's just gotta go hard. On the turtles. There will be learning from what fails. There will be a number of successes that will be to this generation what Nest and Tesla and First Solar were to prior ones. What is inexorable and will not change is the imperative that we have got to decarbonize all facets of the economy, period. And I don't know what it will ultimately take. I don't know if it is the number of climate refugees crossing this country's southern border going up by an order of magnitude. I don't know if it is real estate losses in coastal regions or fire-prone regions becoming large enough to destabilize the insurance system. I don't know if it is mass deaths of the elderly in Western European countries where straight up air conditioning is just less common. Like, look at the death toll of the elderly in France every summer. But there will come a series of tipping points in different places in different parts of the world where negative externalities will be priced in, and the adoption criteria for decarbonization at scale will move. We don't know when, right? Like, I believe that happens in 10 plus or minus 20 years. Like, it could have already happened. I'm not sure. Maybe, but in that time frame, absolutely. So I frankly get a little bit less stressed about, where is there a capital gap this year, next year, whatever else. It's going to move around. The finance system gets increasingly robust and increasingly resilient at all stages. On average, over time, we can do this.
Do you have the same optimism for the founders and what they're working on? I mean, you just mentioned a lot of things that can happen to us where we become the turtles, and now I'm very scared. There's someone working on all of these things, right? There are more sort of heat pumps and mini splits, and there are climate adaptation hawks and risk modelers in insurance using AI to find out where these dollars are really going to need to go. Somebody's there. Somebody's working on it. Does that bring you more optimism, or do you think we're just throwing money after a problem we'll never solve?
No more. I mean, it's because of you. We specialize in sort of crazy early stage things at the brink, right? We backed a company called Lilac Solutions. It's become the leader in direct lithium extraction, how we'll get the 20 to 30x more lithium that we need to electrify the world's vehicle fleet. That company was at risk of risking payroll if our check didn't come in, couldn't get an audience, right? 6 years ago. We backed a proposition from a Valley Tech Company founder that was initially a side project to do permanent removal of carbon. That company is called Charm Industrial, has run the table of carbon removal contracts from the biggest tech companies, from Stripe to Shopify to Microsoft, was an unsellable idea in the Valley at formation just a few years ago. The analogy I always think about is, remember Thomas Malthus? Remember that from science class? You know, the dude in the late 18th, early 19th centuries who drew out this very clear Malthusian pair of curves that had that the population of people was going up exponentially, the food supply was going up geometrically. At some point, the line would cross the curve. And I think it was widespread, massive famine and death. Like, that was his language for what the future held for humanity. All of that was true based on the premises that you would depart from at the time. The X factor missing that equation was human ingenuity. You know, it was creativity for crazy-ass ideas that were untenable or unsellable and driven forward by the will of entrepreneurs who willed their creation into being in the face, of opposition and lack of willingness to believe from the world at large. That is an inexhaustible and renewable resource every time a bell rings in a hospital maternity ward. And that is what will get us through to the other side.
Woo-woo.
Yeah, I love that. Craig, can you speak about how that might also play into unlikely partnerships? Maybe help and expertise and investment coming from places you might not expect?
Yeah, absolutely. And we talked about this earlier. We have investors in our fund that are traditional energy companies, so oil and gas. And we pride ourselves on working really, really well with those groups. And if you go to Houston, every major energy company in the world has some sort of corporate business development, venture, R&D group there that is looking to deploy capital into alternatives to their core business model. And you can certainly make a very good case that at the upper levels of those companies, they may not be that serious about changing their business, right? But the people down that we work with, they're very, very serious, and they have capital to deploy. And so our theory has always been, look, we will take their capital and we will deploy it into things that do good. And I do think that those companies scale their capital. I mean, the profits for oil and gas companies the past couple years are insane. They're buying back stock, they're dividending it out. So good or bad, let's peel off some of that money for solutions. And we're very, very happy to do it. And I think they have a big role in the capital stack. So we talked about growth areas. Those are companies who, if they believe they can make money off of the technology, they will fund, they will JD first of a kind facilities because they know how to build these things. And so I think they are an underappreciated part of that capital stack.
The couple of the statistics that come up in the Activate circles, which works a lot with deep industrial B2B kind of technologies, is 80% of all the energy that we actually consume, like power and movement and heat, is actually coming from a molecule, not an electron. It's not the outlet. 80% of that is a molecule of work. And we will need to decarbonize that, which is far bigger than what the solar panels can account for, as well as 50% plus, which is the latest data I saw from, I think, about June of last year, of all climate investment came directly from an oil company. And so if that's acquisitions by companies like Oxy or direct investments from Saudi Aramco, that doesn't count how many of them are LPs in climate funds. Nor does it count things like the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is essentially oil money that's being given to kind of buy more electric cars and decarbonize their society while the carbon ends up in another place. Molly, you titled your whole podcast after this. We need everybody to make this happen.
Yeah. I mean, I want to just co-sign again what Matthew said. I could not agree more that some of the most frustrating parts of the doomer arguments are the idea that we lay down and die, which humans have never done, right? See fire, electricity, penicillin, et cetera, et cetera. It's just not what's going to happen. It's unfathomable. And I have no time or patience for people in their problem porn and purity arguments. about what is the only way to do it, what is the best way to do it, who can and cannot participate. I called the podcast Everybody in the Pool. There's no solution I'm willing to kick out of bed for eating crackers, because I think of tackling the problem of climate like an ecosystem, right? The ecosystem of the planet. If you only focus, if you built, I read that, this is what a nerd I am. I read this in a sci-fi book, The Expanse, one of the Expanse books. There's a great scene where a father and his daughter, the daughter is building a simulation of an ecosystem, a world, and it keeps dying. And he tells her it's because she is over-focused on basically charismatic megafauna, right? We look around and we're like, I like lions and elephants and palm trees. And what makes an ecosystem work is bugs and bacteria and literal dirt. And so I believe that if we tackle this at the ecosystem level, we say, sometimes there's going to be bugs and bacteria, and that might be SaaS software. That might be measuring consumer behavior. It might be the behavior change that we try to invest in Atomasia, all the way up to lions and tigers and bears. And those are, you know, fusion and carbon capture and geothermal. All of it has to happen. There is nothing that can be left on the table. And so I am just not interested in a conversation about like who can and can't play and which can and cannot occur.
Matt, you started the conversation around geopolitical risk. If we want enough batteries, we're going to need the graphite and the lithium and the cobalt. And if we want to move molecules for energy, there's a new set of conversations there. If I'm an early stage founder, how am I supposed to navigate that and build up a climate company that does good for the whole world at the same time? Who do I need to look to, and what kind of de-risking do I need to do for something that may happen 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 miles away from where I'm building?
Yeah, it's funny. When you bring up political and regulatory risk, I sometimes am asked by investors in our fund or by others, you know, how worried are you about the Donald Trump administration of 2025? And I reply, well, I'm more concerned about the Eric Trump administration of 2029, but, you know, we'll deal with that when it comes. I think on one hand, there are layers of risk around any critical input to an envisioned future energy system, right? And in many ways, the energy transition is a materials transition. That's been a theme of our investing work going back for, you know, almost a decade at this point. And can seem very complicated. It's fraught with country risk, currency risk, commodity risk, et cetera. I think there are two things that, you know, give me optimism and hope. One of them, going back to an earlier part of the conversation, is that there are technologies that are just fundamentally better, sort of techno-economically better, either around identifying those critical materials or putting them to work, that in turn diminish the stochastic risks. If you have a fundamentally better techno-economic proposition, you can afford, right, a higher swing in your input costs and maintain profitability because you have a headroom of margin, right, that is not afforded to the incumbent. And we tend to look for propositions like that, where even if only a third of the potential is realized, it still is likely, for example, in the commodity market, to be the beneficiary of the price rather than the setter of the price. The other one is that I think many of these technologies are fundamentally modular and distributed. So if we have been in thrall as a planet to the fact that the good Lord did not see fit to put high-quality petroleum resources equally distributed in all places of the world, you know, when we have a series of end-of-life batteries coming out of EVs and they can be recycled and repackaged into packs for mobile or stationary applications at the point of use, fundamentally better, eliminates the margin stacking of going from one player to another, eliminates transport and other reprocessing costs, but also democratizes access to the resource because it is now no longer found where it was put underneath the Earth's crust. I think that's true for hydrogen and other fuels. I think that's true for building block monomers and polymers. I think that's true for battery materials. I think it's true for metals. And I think there is a more fundamentally distributed and democratized future that's enabled by technology.
Greg, what kind of a signal do you need to see in a founder to navigate that and to be a leader in a space that may not even exist yet, where you both see the potential But in order to get there, you need to be a pretty special type of person and a pretty special magnetic individual to bring on more talent to follow your cause. How does your firm pick that person and know that you found the right one?
I don't know why we were talking about this a couple weeks ago. It turns out most of our founders are first-time founders, first-time CEOs, and it was not a choice. And I do think in some of these areas, the pattern recognition of the past is not as relevant as it is today. And so there's two factors going on. A lot of the people who went through the last wave of clean tech and were executives and had companies that failed did not come back, right? And so, like, there's not I don't think there's a deep pool of seasoned executives in this sector. So we're sort of both forced and excited by, you know, backing these first-time founders, first-time CEOs. And how do you know... I've never been a true founder of a company, and I know that I could not be. And I know what about me makes it not something that's sort of well-suited to my personality and type. And so I'm looking for people who have some of those things that I'm missing. You have to be dogged. You have to be very comfortable with unbelievable amounts of ambiguity, failure, confusion, stress. And so, you know, you're looking for people who can do that. In a lot of the areas we invest in, there's a big technical component. So essentially, you're looking for either the founder or co-founder that has a unique technology insight and capability that that you can back. And so, if there was a formula, I wish I knew it. But we had this just shocking revelation. It was like, wait, these are all first-time founders, and we're talking to another one right now that we may invest in, and it's like, okay, this is now a pattern. Like, something's going on. Either we're doing it intentionally or unintentionally. So if you're a first-time founder, happy to talk to you.
That's phenomenal. Matt, do you have any parting words for the rest of the founders? You've been pretty inspirational so far to the baby turtles, but what else do they need to know before they get out there and take this fight on their own?
Yeah, I think it's just that we can do it. We were having this conversation in this group beforehand, and there was something Craig pointed out that was so insightful. I am at risk of borrowing your language, but with attribution, what were you saying? The world that we have today, the technology we have today, like, they've all scaled, right?
Correct. Yes. I was just saying what we didn't have 15 years ago is a example to look back on, like solar, wind, and batteries, and say, these things scaled. Like, people are putting them in today, not necessarily because they want to save the earth or save the environment. They're putting them because they're great, better solutions for a lot of things that we need. Many of that stuff was either VC funded or VC participated, or VCs had a role at some place in the ecosystem in making these things happen. I think about solar. First Solar is kind of an interesting example, but just even outside of First Solar, by the time I got involved, it was clear these things were commodities. China was stepping up their solar panel manufacturing. But there was still a role to play for venture capital. We invested, when I was at Accel, in Sunrun, now the leading residential solar company. There was investments in finance and development and software and tools and racking and inverters, all things that, you know, venture capital helped scale this industry. And so when I look at all of that, and then I look at the new set of things that people are working on, whether it's hydrogen or different materials or carbon capture utilization, there's an example, right? And it wasn't a century long example. This stuff all scaled up in 1 to 2 decades, which is roughly the time frame that I need to see to make a venture investment.
Yeah, so
I'm excited.
We can do this. We are doing this. Present tense.
Yeah, don't believe too much of the negative news. A lot of progress has been made in the time that you may or may not have been paying attention. Molly, do you feel the same way?
I do. I 100% do. And I had this interesting pivot. I gave up on journalism, right? I was like, storytelling doesn't work. I don't have time to change minds. Editors don't want to tell these stories because they think they're vegetables and no one cares about them. I'm just going to go to venture and write checks and fund baby turtles. And then I got there and immediately was like, oh, crap, we need a lot of storytelling. The founders need storytelling. The investors need storytelling. They need to be able to tell stories to each other about why these markets will continue to exist. It is so important that we all speak in a different way about this, and that the way we speak about it is that, in fact, we can do it, and people are doing it. And Cleantech 1.0, $1 billion went into these technologies, and $2 billion came out. Like, in no way was that a failure. And so we have to do that. And frankly, also, capitalism can work for this. Like, venture capital is risky capital. This is our job, to take this risk. I'm like acting like a non-radio professional. I'm popping all over the place on my microphone. But take this risk. This is our job. Get it done.
That's a great way to put it. Well, on behalf of myself, Calvin, and Activate, as well as our esteemed panel, thank you all very much for showing up for our podcast, and have a great rest of the conference.